This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us today on our Main Street all across the state of North Dakota. And today on our show, we'll hear from a new Main Street essayist. Alexander Cusa is passionate about nurturing global citizenship, which he does by being a self-proclaimed ambassador for Rwanda. He's one of the writers of the Think Global, Act Local column published in Fargo Monthly Magazine, and he visited with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg about his work and background.
Alexandre, thank you so much for joining us today.
Merci beaucoup for having me.
The sort of impetus behind the column, the Think Global, Act Local, is very much informed by your background. You've grown up in several different countries and really traveled the world a lot to the point that you call yourself a third culture kid. What is a third culture kid and how did you become one?
So I stumbled upon this book. A friend of mine who identify as well as a third culture kid told me about it, and I think basically this notion comes from how American missionaries and diplomats in general would, you know, have their kid grow up outside of the USA, so Japan, East Asia, Africa, and then when they would come back to the US, let's say when their kid were like, it's time to go to college and I want to come to the US, they would come back, and when they were overseas, obviously they were seen as American. But when they came back to the U.S., Americans were like, I mean, you're American, but you don't have a lot of our references of growing up. So that's where you end up creating somewhat of the third bubble of saying, you know what, if when I'm home, people say you're not from home. And when I'm overseas, people say you're from that home. You end up saying, you know what, I'm home everywhere.
Where do you feel at home? Do you have to create your own sense of feeling at home?
That's a great question. Both of my parents are from Rwanda, but I was born in Paris. That's where they met when they were studying in university. And so Rwanda has always been my home, but I grew up in the Rwandan diaspora, so outside of Rwanda. And the amazing thing of when I'm in Rwanda, I just can keep quiet and walk in the street and feel at home. But as soon as I know, I open my mouth, or if I have a lot of references, people can tell, I don't know if you grew up your whole life in Rwanda kind of thing.
Sure.
That's where you got to at some point have some kind of a checkbox of things you need to feel at home, and you make home wherever you are. But usually Rwanda is up there. Rwanda is home, that's for sure. And then bits and parts of places I've lived. And right now, my home away from home is, you know, the Red River Valley, so...
And we should mention that how you really became a third culture kid is mostly because of your mother's work for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
Or UNHCR for a shorter version.
Yep, absolutely. just tell us about how your mother's work impacted your point of view.
Great. That's a great point. So being a UN kid... So my mom retired a year ago, so I always joke that I lost the status. I used to be a UN kid, now I'm just a kid. But a bit like military kids, these are the people I could connect the most with. Every 3-4 years, we had to rotate and rotate and rotate. So automatically, you had to develop some kind of adaptive skill of knowing what it is to every time. And I don't want to use the word to start from scratch because it was still a very privileged upbringing of, I mean, we changed location, but we came with resources and you know, and means of relocating, right? But I had to somewhat, from a social perspective, to make new friends and then make new friends, you know. And it was pre-Facebook era, I guess. So there was no, I'm going to keep following what you guys are doing.
Right. How are you writing
country
on anyone's walls?
Right? So it was mostly to be learning how to adapt, learning how to have some kind of awareness of the self, and also awareness of others in order to be respectful and not impede on people's manners or customs. So it was a lot of times you come and you have some kind of an orientation week in your mind of I'm going to observe and sit in the passenger seat before I dare to maybe be a co-pilot or even a pilot, who knows.
So what sticks out in your mind as something that's typically Rwandan? Can you go to an airport, let's just say you're in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. and you can still look at somebody and say, that person's Rwandan?
Oh, that's an... Rwanda being a super, super tiny country, so slightly smaller than Maryland, yet we have almost 12 million people. We share a lot of facial traits and custom, if I may say, with... So north of us, we have Uganda. South, we have Burundi. West, we have the Republic Democratic of the Congo. And east, Tanzania. So usually... these neighboring countries, a bit like, you know, the Midwest, how you could say, how do you distinguish them from Iowa or Minnesota? Kind of, right. We're all Midwestern. So, but as soon as maybe someone opens their mouth, maybe now I can be, oh, I recognize either an accent, even if they're speaking French or English, two languages we speak in Rwanda, I would be like, I can tone an accent here. Or if they speak in Rwanda, that's even best. I'm being like, you're from my country. But I would be lying to you if I said I can just walk in a room and say, you over there, sir or ma'am.
Yeah.
But I would say that Rwandan people are beautiful people. So I could be just biased and say, whenever I see a beautiful African, I'm like, I think they're from Rwanda.
Well, I love that you use the word beautiful there because we know each other socially as
yes.
well. And you have sort of texted, emailed, and Facebooked me a few times and I think it's okay for me to say I always have find something beautiful in what you write, and very much I'll say something like, Alex, you're so smart, and then you never just say thank you. You say thank you, and then you go on to say something, a proverb from where you came from or something immediately that your mother instilled in you. You really have this sense of you're an individual, but you are a member of society, and the society is sort of larger than the individual.
Yeah, so it's always thinking, I come from a culture where we have a collectivistic approach to things. So any appraisal or any, you know, compliments directed towards me, I always want to make sure people remember that I'm not just... I didn't make myself, you know, kind of thing. I'm a product of my environment. You know, they say it takes, maybe in the Midwest, I should say, take a farm to grow, but it takes a village to raise a child. So it's always saying, hey, for instance, people say, you're so adaptive. You blend everywhere you go. Well, thanks to my mom, being a UN kid, I had to, you know, navigate a lot of communities and societies. If you say, well, you're so well-rounded. Well, thanks to my mom, she exposed me to so many people. So that's where always making sure people know you're counting your blessings, and as well you're you're grateful to people around me, because I wouldn't be me without, first of all, without my mom. Her surrounding me with wonderful people and also people accepting me, I guess, because again, oh, who's that new kid? Every 3-4 years, there was a new kid in the block, and that was me. So thanks to people as well for being accepting of yours truly.
Then you moved to the United States eventually to come to college. You study Spanish and communications at Concordia in Moorhead, Minnesota. And America really has this fascination with the self-made man. And then you come to the Midwest in particular, where people are very stoic. They don't like to necessarily talk about their own accomplishments. But just I want to talk about sort of that blending of you came from a society that's very much collective-minded, and now you're living in one that's very much individual-minded. What parts are hard for you?
So interestingly enough, I always invite my Midwestern friends to think that the Rwandan culture sometimes reminds me of the Scandinavian / upper Midwestern culture, because Rwandan as well are known for being more reserved, not as exuberant and flamboyant. Maybe I'm a typical Rwandan. But usually being more not so like tapping on my own shoulder. Did you know what I did? I did this. And when you think about it, actually, the way sometimes you direct a compliment at me and you see how I always redirect to, no, it's not. And so you could see you see it as a Ubuntu, I am because we are. But that's maybe Norwegians or Scandinavian who say it another way, but it's the same. And I've seen being at events where, let's say, Bjorn Jensen receives the compliment and they say, wow.
I know Bjorn Jensen.
Well, we all do know one. And they would say, well, you know, it's not me. And they redirect to someone else. So it's, again,
it's
different step on the dance floor, but at the end of the day, it's a melodious move. But trying to be more, quote-unquote, individualistic has not been as easy. But I've learned to accept at least that, yeah, there's a different way of doing things. And that's one of the perks, actually, when you travel a lot. You start realizing your diction can no longer be, this is weird, because suddenly it's an orange and you used to eat apples. You're like, this is different. Mm. So coming to the U.S., I knew it was a very individualistic MySpace. The one thing I've struggled is maybe the MySpace more rather than the individual. So it's more of a MySpace when it comes to, you know, that private space people will really enjoy. I come from a country where, you know, in Rwanda, it's very fluid. There's not really MySpace. Mm. A simple example. I have a roommate, and it was like, you're on the left side of the room. I'm on the right side of, you know, think of the typical thing in the dorms. And coming from my culture, it's just like, yeah, we have a room. And let's just not disrespect each other. But, yeah, if sometime you're sitting on my bed because, oh, you're on the right side of the room this day, it's okay. Whereas when I came here, I had to learn, the right side of the room is mine. The left side of the room is yours. Please do not sit on my bed. You know, and that's a small example of many.
We have a bubble.
Right, kind of thing. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yikes. And coming, again, when you think about space from a culture where when you say hi to a person from another gender, you can, you know, do the kiss. So think about it, that private space of the face as well. Here is very like, oh, maybe high five, hugs as well. Don't get me wrong. So it was a lot of readjusting on the space of the individual. But again, at some point, you just got to accept it, make errors, and say, hey, sorry, I'm just new and I'm learning. Willing to say, hey, I'm new and I'm learning. Yeah. People are like, okay, for this time, I'll forgive you.
Have you adopted any habits from here that you really like and maybe even want to bring back each time you go home to Rwanda?
Yes, I've really enjoyed the way people literally want to not only give back, but want to ensure it becomes a culture. And usually you would think you have to be a very established person or super wealthy to give back. Whereas here I've seen that at every level you can give back to your community and you don't need to be, you know, super wealthy or super connected. You can incrementally give back, and I think that is just the USA is known for being one of the best, if not the best, marketing guru platform. So every society, I think, is part of the human kind to want to give back and to want to belong and to want to better one's community. However, in the USA, they've mastered the way of not only you do it, but you have a very elegant way of showcasing it. Because, for instance, I remember seeing, wow, all those buildings with names. And then I realized, oh, these are people that have, let's say, donated to the school, for instance. And I was like, and I'm 100% sure that across the world people are doing it as well. But maybe they don't put their names because, I don't know, it's not in their culture. So it's always interesting. It's always interesting to see how different things can be approached. But I just learned how to celebrate people that give back, and yeah, now it's and how to survive harsh winters. That's the only thing I'm going to have to take back.
Yeah, because you're Rwanda, temperate to subtropical area, lots of mountains and savanna. None of those words apply to your current living situation.
But I was fortunate prior to coming here, I was in Geneva, Switzerland. But I always told my friends in Switzerland that I moved from the fridge to the deep freezer. So I was used to the cold and the snow, but that was just the fridge in Switzerland. But here I moved to the deep freezer, so that was another level.
Well, let's virtually go to Rwanda here. About a third of the world's wild gorilla population living in Rwanda.
Yes.
You have seen gorillas in real life.
Yes.
I'm kind of jealous of that, I'm not going to lie.
They're pretty impressive and they're very intelligent because they're, as you know, very, very strong animals. They could literally, you know, take your life away in a snippet.
But they
but
don't.
They're very, you know, calm, and they eat just bamboos, and they're like the cousins of the pandas, you know, just relax animals like that. And you can get pretty close. Just you don't have to stare back at the alpha. Each pack has an alpha, the silverback, basically. And as well, you know, no flashes. There's a couple rules to not do. Don't initiate any contact. If they come to you, just, you know, be submissive and don't move. But in general, they're just there and they're hanging out and they're amazing, amazing, yeah, primates, I guess.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of being with horses. You know, you can be right up to a 2,000-pound horse and you know it could kill you.
Absolutely.
But that probably it's not going to.
Yeah. As long as you're not a threat, right?
Right, yeah. Well, as a radio producer, I usually have a very threatening physique. You know, one thing I was really interested to learn about Rwanda is the banning of plastic bags. I'm not going to lie. I appreciate this. Do you have a sense of why that was? And I know you're not a Rwandan government official.
Yes.
But the steps that the government is taking that you do follow.
So in, I think it was 2008 or 2009, in the spirit of being one of the cleanest country slash even city, Kigali City, the capital, is that we wanted to preserve, again, slightly smaller than Maryland. We have a super small country. And if we don't take care of our country, it could pretty soon, you know, be polluted and not go well. So one of the initiatives were, how can we have a very clean environment, clean city, and also instill in people that you have to take agency in keeping your city clean. So the first step was obviously banning plastic bags, and now everything is, they have brown paper bag. Even when you land at the Kigali airport, they say, hey, if you have any plastic bags, exchange against a brown paper bag, because they take it and really, ensure you don't bring any in the country. And the second thing is, every last Saturday of the month, we have something we call Umuganda, where basically everyone comes out of their home and their neighborhood and, again, clean together. So it brings a togetherness. It brings a way of getting to know your neighbor. But again, that agency of saying, hey, we want our city to be clean, but we're going to make sure we kind of roll up our sleeve and do it. So I've seen other, I think now Kenya recently trying to, you know, follow what Rwanda is doing to keep it clean. And right now, Kigali City is the cleanest city in Africa. And I think it's normally some good initiative from our government, but as well as the people saying, you know what, that's we enjoy walking and not having a plastic bag, you know, just flying around in a tree or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So
I have heard, though, that it has led to some trafficking in plastic bags.
Humans are going to be humans.
Well, this is an enormous question for when we're wrapping up here. But I also was intrigued to read that it's one of a very few countries in the world that has a female majority national parliament. The sadness behind this is it grew out of the Rwandan genocide, where there was a severe shortage of males. But you growing up, you know, sort of mostly after that time, or coming of age after that time, and only being aware of female majority in parliament. Do you have any thoughts?
It's fantastic, because when you think of a true democracy, so the people for the people by the people, anywhere you go around the world, usually there's 51 to 52% of women. So I think it would make sense to have the parliament have its people represented equally to the general population. And we have more women than men in Rwanda. So, but now we take it more than this. 30% are locked seat just for women, regardless. And those 30% of women were able to lobby to now have 64, passing some of the Scandinavian country. And they've passed amazing initiative, maternity leave, many things that usually, or even the access to property. Pre-genocide Rwanda, women could not own land. But now again, them having their voice heard at the parliament after the genocide against the Tutsi, ensure they, you know, made sure people know we need to have access to owning land and we need better maternity leave. So many voices that usually men cannot represent adequately. And it's a true honor to have people sometimes mention Rwanda for this. And we always know that educate a man, you educate an individual, educate a woman, you educate a nation. So you want to make sure women are empowered and women are re-given leadership position, not given, because they had, in ancient Rwanda, it was the king and the queen mother that basically, you know, governed our kingdom. So it's, for us, it was just part of our even root culture to bring back women to the decisional table. So yay, Rwanda.
Well, Alex, you are an ambassador for your country. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup.
And, of course, we started this conversation talking about the Think Global, Act Local column that he writes for Fargo Monthly with some friends as well. And we are going to share one of those essays today because, you know, when you travel, you think you have to have a lot of money. And Alex is going to share some tips about how you can actually travel without leaving.
Warm greetings from the land of a thousand hills, Rwanda. If I was financially super confident, I would travel the entire world. How many times have you heard someone say that? Have you thought of being a globetrotter but were fiscally timid? I know this is often my case. What if I told you that you could travel the globe without leaving the prairie? Impossible, right? Well, let me convince you otherwise. You know what they say? If you cannot travel the world, let the world come to you. We are natural storytellers. Meeting people from various corners of the world, living in the community, is a great way to hear their stories. During cultural festivals or presentations, ask questions about traditions. Their tales will make you travel in space and time to wherever their life journey started. I have always enjoyed listening to stories and meeting new people at cultural centers like the Yamkams Museum in Moorhead and the Heritage Center in Bismarck. Learning a new language is the best way to shift your cultural paradigm and have a different perspective on your own culture. Learning a new language is like linguistically putting a mirror in front of your mother tongue. You will not forget it. On the contrary, you will even understand better how other people say the same thing as you do, but with a different cultural lens. Volunteer by teaching English as a second language in public schools. By teaching, you learn even more about others' perspective by linguistically walking in their apprentice shoes. The exotic accent, the pronunciation of English words, and the exposure to another language will make you realize the melodious benefit of listening to other languages. Travel by discovering some intriguing and exotic smells of spices from all over the world at different ethnic markets, or visit local restaurants that serve food from all over the world. This has been one of my favorite ways to wander globally for an instance of a smell. Once it has caressed your olfactive sensors and you will feel convinced, you will stimulate your taste buds and challenge your palate through culinary exploration when tasting new food from another tradition, region, or country. Traditional clothing is a great way to see the differences and similarities in custom when it comes to dressing up for special occasions. I'm always fascinated by the vibrancy traditional wear can bring to the room. Usually there's a story behind every traditional cloth. Remember to always stay curious and even to be bold by asking where they got it from, because chances are you can buy one in town. Traveling can be done through our five human senses. By trying these bank account-friendly tips, you will nurture the dormant globetrotter in you. You are one smell, taste, dance, attire, new language, and conversation away from your next global journey. Until next time, bon voyage. This is Alexandre Cusa.
Alexandre Cusa is a community liaison for Folkways, which works to nurture culture creators. He's one of the writers of the Think Global, Act Local column published in Fargo Monthly magazine, and he studied in Rwanda, Switzerland, Guinea, Ethiopia, and the United States. Cusa holds bachelor's degrees in communications and Spanish from Concordia College in Moorhead, and he's pursuing a master's from North Dakota State University. Coming up on Main Street, tiny mountain North Dakota hosted another big crowd to celebrate its Icelandicness, and the Prime Minister of Iceland showed up, and Minot is getting ready for its 30th annual Great Tomato Festival. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The director of North Dakota's Office of Management and Budget says a series of strategy review meetings with executive branch agencies were very positive and generated a number of ideas for providing services more cost-effectively. Joe Morissette says the meetings came as the agencies were starting to prepare their budget requests for inclusion in Governor Burgum's executive budget, which will be given to the legislature at its organizational session in December.
You know, as budgets are typically submitted in July and August, it's a compressed time frame as we finalize the governor's budget and make decisions on what we're going to include in there. This does allow some additional time kind of on the front end from an idea being put forward between then and when the governor's budget is finalized. There is more time now because of these meetings and more time to kind of flesh out those ideas, and I think we'll have some good proposals and policy ideas that we can bring forward to the session.
Morissette says he hopes to continue those sessions 2 years from now. North Dakota's chief information officer says the state continues to move toward consolidation of information technology. Sean Riley says the information technology department is doing what he termed deep data collection of who is responsible for IT services for which department and what systems they use.
We use today 7+ different systems for service management. So if you go out in the general public would be receptive to the term help desk. And they know the term help desk. Well, if you think of that, today we're using 7 different ways to deliver help desk services across 17 cabinets. There's no need for that. Organizations that are 10 times our size can do it with one way.
Riley says it's all part of the concept of reinventing government to make it more efficient.
We can be more effective with the staff, more effective with the tools, cost less overall, and then those people that we're freeing up are freed up to be able to get a whole lot more other work done that we really want to be able to do in other places.
Riley says he will have a proposal for the 2019 legislature to consider. And U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao says North Dakota has become a national leader in the use of unmanned aircraft. Chao was in Bismarck for a forum on transportation infrastructure sponsored by the American Conservative Union. Chao says this technology has really taken off around the country.
There have been registered now more than 1 million drones. There's even a new job category, which 2 years ago didn't exist. And that's called a drone operator. We never had that before. Now there are over 50,000 drone operators.
North Dakota was one of the states chosen for the integration pilot program where regular aircraft and drones share the same airspace.
So through this program and the testing being conducted across the state, North Dakota has become an epicenter of drone innovation.
Chao also talked about some of the other efforts to improve transportation infrastructure, such as cutting back on red tape for approval of infrastructure projects. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Flyover country is a phrase that has been tied to North Dakota, so you might be surprised by the number of people who flocked to a small town in the northeast corner of the state. The crowd included the Prime Minister of Iceland, Her Excellency Katrin Jakobsdóttir. She traveled to Mountain, North Dakota, population 92, to give a keynote address at the annual August the Deuce Festival, the longest-running ethnic festival in the state and the largest Icelandic heritage festival in the nation. She visited with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg about why parts of North Dakota and Manitoba hold a special place in the hearts of Icelanders.
I think every Icelander wants to visit. You know, it's a very popular spot for Icelandic tourists to come here to these places and learn more about their maybe ancestors. I've already met actually a few relatives here, which is amazing.
No way.
Yes, yes. And that's always intriguing for us in Iceland because we're such a small country. You know, we are just under 350,000 people speaking Icelandic language, which, you know, hardly anyone speaks. So it's interesting to come here both to the United States and Canada and realize that here we have another cultural center here for Iceland.
And speaking of culture and cultural heritage, this festival, the August the Deuce Festival in Mountain, North Dakota, is the longest-running ethnic festival in the state of North Dakota. It's the largest Icelandic heritage festival. And sometimes we do this thing in the United States where we keep up traditions from the old country a little bit longer than in, you know, like present day Iceland. Now, I understand that Iceland celebrates Independence Day on June 17th. This is a little bit different. This is more focused on the handing over of the Constitution from Denmark. But is this something that we're only celebrating in the United States?
Actually, this is also celebrated in Iceland, in Vestmanna Islands, which is the only town in Iceland which has a specific national parade on this day, because it was King Christian the IX who visited the country and brought it the first constitution. So that was the reason why it was kept. So that has actually been a continuous celebration here. And I gather that this is the oldest ethnical festival here in the States.
Yeah, this is the 119th year of it.
But she's still going on. So I think that's really remarkable that it has been going on for all that time, for over a century.
There have only been two prime ministers of Iceland going back to 1904 that are female. You're one of them. And a background of an expert in crime fiction. How did you end up on the world stage?
Yes, I have a background in crime fiction and Icelandic literature, and I used to study Icelandic and Icelandic literature and worked for a publishing house and taught. But I entered the Icelandic parliament in 2007. I was just a normal opposition parliamentarian to begin with. As you might know, politics in Iceland have been quite turbulent ever since the crisis in 2008. So we've actually had, you know, I was elected, as I say, in 2007. I've gone through five parliamentary elections in 10 years, and we've had several governments. So what we are doing now in Iceland, we have a government that really stretches from the right side of politics to the left side of politics, with three parties, right, center, and left. A political innovation, you could call it that. And this, I think, was the best choice after the last election. It's quite highly unusual, but I think it's an important government, really, to ensure more political stability in Iceland, hopefully, and to avoid the polarization that has become a tendency in Iceland as everywhere else in the world.
What was your first thought when you were asked to head and to form this coalition government that you said, spanning left-wing to right side, that includes a lot of turmoil? In recent years, there's been something like four prime ministers in 2 years and two noted figures in Icelandic politics named in the Panama Papers very recently, one of whom is still serving in your cabinet. Boy, that's a big task that you have.
It is a big task. But what we see also in Iceland is the tendency that we're having more and more parties. So it's a very different landscape than the landscape I entered as a parliamentarian in 2007. So, but it's also interesting and exciting times. And I think democracy and politics are faced with totally new challenges with the new social media, the technological changes we're seeing. So I think politics really need to reinvent themselves, if I may say so. That means that you have to work differently. That means you just can't always pressure things through majority, but you need to seek a broader consensus on issues, and you need to be ready to tackle the differences openly. I think actually politics, not only in Iceland, but everywhere in the world, are really faced with these challenges, and it a lot depends on how we react to them.
What do you hope will be the legacy of your term? I know you've done a lot for gender equal pay, pledging for a carbon-free Iceland by 2040. If you had to pick one thing, what would it be?
Well, climate change is actually a flagship, but I want to see something real happening before I leave office, because it's a very important issue for all of us, and we are heading for a carbon neutral Iceland in 2040, and I think we can do a lot because we have renewable energies and we are such a small society, so it should be easy to mobilize everybody in that. Gender equality, another flagship, but it's always difficult to talk about your own legacy, specifically when in politics you never know what each day is going to bring. So I'm at least sad on those issues, and I'm also very sad on that, you know, Iceland has been doing well economically, but we really need to ensure that prosperity reaches everybody in the country.
I saw that Moody's recently bumped it up. This is a big change since the financial crisis of 2008.
Yes, we have been doing amazingly well on the economic side, actually. both because I think all the governments, all those governments that have been serving have done their bit. But I think also that we have been lucky. You know, we had a volcanic eruption in Eyjafjallajökull, which we thought would ruin our tourism industry, but it actually lifted it up. So what we have seen is a huge increase in tourism, and now that has become our biggest export revenue. But we need to ensure that the economic growth, which has been good, that all the people of Iceland will feel the results of that. So I think that's probably the biggest issue. Also,
we're having a clock tapped at us, so I'll just one more. Where should, if people can only go to one place in this fantastically beautiful country that is Iceland, and don't say you know your office.
I'm not gonna ask them to come to my office. That's not particularly interesting, but you know. Of course, I come from Reykjavik, so I do hope everybody enjoys themselves in Reykjavik. But I'd also like to mention Snæfellsnes, with the Snæfellsnes Glacier, which Jules Verne makes so famous in his book. And I think that's a really spectacular place. So if I only must mention one place, but point being is that I really love the nature of my country. And always when I go home, I really get emotional because I love every bit of that country.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
We'll feature more coverage from August the Deuce on Main Street. Ashley is putting together a piece with other voices, including a woman who traveled from Iceland. Coming up, Minot prepares for its 30th annual Great Tomato Festival.
Support is provided by Cable One High-Speed Internet, designed to offer a streaming connection that allows customers to watch movies and videos without buffering or interruption. More information at 1-855-CABLE-1.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Peggy Miller. She's by our microphone in our Bismarck studio. Peggy is the founder and CEO of the Great Tomato Festival in Minot, and it's this Wednesday.
Coming right up.
Peggy, how did all this get started?
Well, 30 years ago, I happened to be on a board of directors for the Minot Community Opera. At that time, I think it was still called Minot Community. Now it's Western Plains Opera. And, of course, you know how it is with arts organizations. They're always struggling and trying to, you know, bring in a little bit of cash. And so a few of us women batted some ideas around and came up with an idea that we could have something in August when there wasn't too much going on. And we came up with the idea of celebrating the tomato, and that's how the Great Tomato Festival got started.
And this year you're helping the Minot Public Library, the Taube Museum of Art, and the Minot Symphony Orchestra?
That's it.
All right. So what is it? What happens at the Great Tomato Festival?
Well, essentially it's a food event. And that's why we've been so successful, I think, because we started out with one menu and we've stuck with it for all these years. And the word gets out that this is really some good food. And because we have a classic menu that is, well, features, we can get into that because it's kind of an interesting story, the backstory of where the smoked pork chop idea really got started.
Yes, because you have a pork chop coordinator on your team.
Well, we do. We do. And you got to have that because, I mean, it's very important. We've got several gentlemen who really know how to run a smoker. But this all goes back to, you know, many, many years ago, they built this tradition and it's been handed down to generations. And so it's very, very important. And as a matter of fact, my husband Jeff is in Minot right now getting the marinade ready because you have to marinate, well, you know, 900 pork chops, and that's quite an undertaking.
Wow. Well, let's go through the menu for those foodies out there who may want to invest $30 in a ticket for the upcoming Great Tomato Festival in Minot.
Okay, here you go. Well, we start out with hors d'oeuvres. We have we make our own salsa because we do, of course, feature tomatoes. And in the process of creating those stuffed tomatoes, you have to hollow them out, of course. And so all of that goes into a big pail and off it goes to the kitchen. And the chefs up there make a homemade salsa. And so we start out with chips and salsa. Then we have other hors d'oeuvres. We make a little stuffed cherry tomato, which is delicious. I think it might be a lot of people's favorite item on the menu. And we make a little cucumber sandwich. And so that's all included, and it's on your table when you arrive. And then we have the smoked pork chop, of course, and we make a stuffed tomato. We've been using the same recipe. That recipe came from Vivian Marigos, from the famous Marigos family in Minot. And then we do a beer bread, individual little loaves of beer bread, and we make a cucumber and tomato salad. And then we have a chocolate cake for dessert.
And this is all at the North Dakota State Fair Center in Minot, a well-known location in your city. And the gates open at 5:30 on Wednesday, and the social hour starts at 6.
Yes.
And the dinner starts at 7.
Yes.
So we've gone through the classic menu, the one that has sustained you for, 30 years or so. You mentioned 900 pork chops. How many people are you expecting? 900?
Well, we have served, actually, believe it or not, 900 people, which is quite a feat. And that was one of our, peak years. It goes up and down a little bit. This year we sell sponsorships, and that's essentially, the way that we sell tickets. People buy a package of 10 tickets, mm-hmm. and they become a sponsor. So we've sold 80 sponsorships this year, community businesses in the community, professional people. And then we usually sell, maybe about 100 tickets individually. So it'll be, we'll sell about, and then we've got kind of a formula we've figured out about, what percentage of those people are going to show up. So we can pretty much forecast how many people we're going to have just by ticket sales.
Okay.
And you learn this stuff over the years.
Well, this certainly, if you do the math, you're raising tens of thousands of dollars here. Of course, you've got expenses. So how important is this as a community fundraiser?
Well, it's important. I think that people that have been, because it has rotated through a lot of different fine arts organizations over the years. And sometimes it can make the difference of, just kind of making it through another year, depending on, how well funded you are. So it makes a difference. And I have been kind of particular about how you will allocate those funds. I would prefer that they would not just go into the general budget. And so we've had things like, I think the symphony has purchased, last year it was a new horn. Now, a horn, I don't know exactly what that is, but they're very happy with their new horn. And so, it does really contribute to the value of their product.
Well, I hope it has a great Tomato Festival sticker on it.
Well, now that you mentioned it, I better get one on there.
You also have silent auctions and that take place during the event, and raffle tickets you're selling for travel prizes.
We are this year. We just started this raffle concept last year. This first year we're doing the raffle. Last year we did the live auction for the first time, which we've never done, except for just particular items maybe, But it's all a silent auction. It's a fantastic silent auction. We have up to 300 items on our auction, and something for everyone. There's something, you can probably pick up something for $20, or you can go all the way on up to, hundreds of dollars. One year we had a car that we auctioned, a classic Jaguar, I think it was. So that was a big item.
Yeah.
And then we have they were selling the raffle tickets. The raffle ticket includes a choice of a trip to New York with Broadway shows or Cancun, Mexico. And then we're having some of these trips that are going to be on the live auction as well. I think that will be limited to about 10 items, but they'll all be pretty upscale.
So lots of ways to rein in some money for the three organizations you're supporting this year, the library, the art museum, and the symphony orchestra. Now, you may have mentioned this. Certainly the month of August is good for tomatoes. It's also good for zucchini and other things. So why the tomato?
It just rang. You think about August, and of course, if you're a gardener, well, no matter who you are, if you like tomatoes, can't wait for those good old North Dakota tomatoes. And while we were discussing it, it just kind of popped out of my head. And I said, well, do you want to have the Great Tomato Festival? And everybody just said, that's it.
Well, isn't there a big festival in Spain where they throw tomatoes at each other?
What a waste of tomatoes.
Yeah.
I've never really been on that deal.
So put them on a plate. Let's do something
Absolutely.
Good with them here.
Let's do that.
And so you've got something called the menu venue at the event. What is that?
Well, it's just a part of the silent auction where we obtain, and it could be a meal that someone likes to prepare. You've got lots of people that like to to do that.
Oh, yes,
entertaining.
Yeah.
And so they'll put together a menu and they'll put it on the menu venue. And then also we have a lot of contributors that will give us gift certificates for restaurants, and we'll put those on there. And I think I think the committee does a barbecue. You know, the people on the committee kind of put their heads together and come up with it could be anything that involves food.
Well, and you've got tomato displays from Marketplace Foods.
Oh, absolutely. They go all out for that. They do. One year they did a volcano, and it was actually, vapor was coming out of it. I don't know how they did it. But, yeah, Marketplace, they're very, very on board, and we just love them for what they do for us.
And so besides the food and the auctions and the fundraising, there's jazz music as well, and I assume somebody cuts the rug occasionally.
You know, we don't really do that. It's back, it's Dakota Dixie, and they just kind of play. So we have, we really enjoy their music. And, we don't have any room to dance, as a matter of fact.
That's too many tomatoes.
Yeah. Tomatoes are taking the stage. Let's put it that way.
Well, Peggy, when you started this back in 1989, did you imagine it would last as long as it has?
Like it would be my lifetime work?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I probably wouldn't have gotten into it. But it's worked out, for the first, these good 10 years, I was pretty much on my own and just kind of developing it. I knew, as the years go by, where you want to go. But I had to learn a lot of skills that I never thought I would learn, but you do it. And but I would say, the groups have been very, very, very much on board, certainly for the last 15 years since I don't live in Minot anymore, so it's pretty difficult to be a hands-on all over the place. And I live in Bismarck now, but they've just taken over, and everybody does what they do, and they all do it well. And it just works.
So it's fair to call this a labor of love.
Absolutely. And it's all volunteer. We don't have any paid administrative help. All of our, it's all about our volunteers.
And so how many people is this? You and how many other people?
Well, we have the working board, and it's not really a board. We're just a committee because we've never incorporated. Probably about 8 of us, representatives, of course, from all the participating groups. But by the time we get done, we've probably got at least 100 volunteers involved because they, of course, do all the food prep. And so, we have a schedule, and they just kind of show up and do their two-hour shifts, it's not as easy to get volunteers as it used to be, but we get it done.
Well, the Great Tomato Festival has a website, greattomatofestival.com. When I went up there, Peggy, I saw lots of sponsors. You've got incredible support in your community.
We do. We really do. And we actually have some sponsors that have been on board with us from the very beginning and have never missed a year. And that's pretty incredible. And because I know the first year that we did it, I went out and got the sponsors, and we only had 10 sponsors. So but you have to go out and get them. And fortunately, I have a couple partners that really, that's our job. And we enjoy going out, driving around and calling on all those people. And that's how we get our sponsors.
And after 30 years, it might get a little hard to say no.
You're probably right. I mean, most people just say, of course. Every once in a while we'll have, but never any long-time people. They would never, they'd never leave us. They want to be on board.
Well, congratulations on your wonderful tenure in this nonprofit community-building event. Peggy Miller is the founder and CEO of the Great Tomato Festival in Minot. It's Wednesday at the North Dakota State Fair Center. Doors open at 5:30. The social hour starts at 6, dinner at 7. There's music and, of course, food and a great cause to celebrate. Peggy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 6th. On a 5-acre plot on the edge of Carrington, North Dakota, Harry Hayashi created a little piece of Japan. The Rainbow Gardens were modeled after traditional Japanese gardens, featuring a stream, fish ponds, and waterfalls. The venue also featured a motel, a music pavilion, and a restaurant. Popular with the locals as well as passing travelers, it was a great place for unique food and great entertainment. It's rumored that the pavilion at Rainbow Gardens hosted such musical greats as Duke Ellington, Conway Twitty, Jimmy Dorsey, Tiny Hill, Wayne King, Blue Baron, Buddy Murrow, and Louis Armstrong. Hayashi was born in Japan, but at age 16, he set his sights on the United States. He worked his way across the ocean as a cabin boy on ocean steamers. On arrival, he lived and worked in Montana and the state of Washington before finding a job at a bakery in Carrington in 1921. Within a year, he opened his own cafe. He hired Anna Firlus, the daughter of German immigrants, to work for him, and it was a fateful meeting. 2 years later, the couple married. Hayashi was a successful and well-liked businessman. Neighbors described him as ambitious and imaginative. However, in 1942, this successful Japanese immigrant faced the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. The government seized his assets. Soon after, Rainbow Gardens closed. On a Sunday morning, while Anna attended church, Hayashi was taken from his home and sent to the Department of Justice Enemy Internment Camp at Fort Lincoln, just south of Bismarck. Today, the site is home to the United Tribes Technical College, but between May 1943 and March 1946, the buildings housed over 4,000 German and Japanese, quote, enemy aliens, unquote. Hayashi's internment was difficult for Anna and Harry's family. Anna and the five children had to find work, including labor in the fields, shocking grain. Hayashi was released from the internment camp before the war ended, but was ordered to remain in Carrington. He reopened Rainbow Gardens in May of 1945. On this date in 1945, a B-29 superfortress dropped the first atomic bomb ever used in warfare on the city of Hiroshima. The devastating event instantly killed 70,000 people and was followed 3 days later by the atomic bombing of Nagasaki, effectively ending World War II. After the war ended, Hayashi closed Rainbow Gardens and opened a restaurant in Carrington named the Miami Grill. In February of 1954, Hayashi died from complications from an accident at the restaurant. A few days after his passing, Harry Hayashi received a letter from the United States government. It was a certificate proving his readiness to become a United States citizen. Today's Dakota Date Book, written by Maria Witham. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Date Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll meet Kelsey Snell, the congressional reporter for NPR. She's in North Dakota to cover the Senate race between Heidi Heitkamp and Kevin Kramer. And Jamestown Area Grief Support Team members Eileen Lisko and Diane Witzig will discuss their upcoming Widow's Retreat. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.